Try to pick up with last week's question. If I leave someone's question out, I don't think it's on purpose. So just resend it. I hope we'll get to finish. It's a very long list. I hope we'll get to finish it. So we'll go back to two points we were talking about last time. But first, I thank you to the Mandels again for hosting us. It's when you do something twice, then it's like a given. It's not a given. It's not a given, and thank you very much to you and your husband. And last time we began also with the idea that houses have the halacha they're accustomed to. So whatever you verified, there are many opinions in halacha. What we're learning here is not, this is the only way to go. If your husband's rav said differently or you learned differently, there are multiple opinions which we can't cover. So nothing that's said here is coming to disqualify anything else. This is my tradition, and people shouldn't come home and then start saying, you know, we did this wrong and that wrong and the other thing wrong. If you verified what you're doing and now you're learning differently, then you have to verify. Maybe what you're doing is perfectly fine. last time I mentioned the story of Rav Halberstam, who, when I asked him about cleaning off the tablecloths, so he refused to answer me. He just said it's mutter and told me I was welcome to leave his office. So I just wanted to clarify that Rav Halberstam Zatzal was a very warm person, and even when he'd tell me to leave, he'd say it with a smile, and he'd say in Yiddish, "Gai gesunte heit," go and be well. And then he'd stop me before I left and he'd say, "You noticed I said gesunte heit. I did bless you. I didn't just say go." He would do it half jokingly. So I felt maybe I gave him a wrong impression. And we also started discussing tefillah for women. It's interesting that women's tefillah has a very special place in Tanakh. We discussed the idea that a woman isn't chayav in davening three times a day, and that a woman does her obligation really with Birchas HaTorah. And we also ended off with mentioning that if a woman has the time to sit on WhatsApp or Facebook, then she should really be spending that time davening. However, there's the baseline. A person should say Birkot HaShachar if a person could. A person should make the blessings about the fact that we can see, the fact that we can stand up, and from there a person has to see what time they have in their day, if they can get in a Shmona Esrei or not. But even the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote that women have to daven, I heard from earlier generations that his wife didn't daven, meaning the idea that you have to, that's provided that you're not obligated to other mitzvot. Now a woman running a house with children, she's obligated to other mitzvot. And we have to remind ourselves sometimes that what we're doing all day, most of our day as a wife, as a mother, is a mitzvah. Changing that diaper is a mitzvah. Meaning if you would volunteer in an orphanage or somewhere else and you'd be changing diapers there, it would be obvious that what you're doing is a mitzvah. So we have to remind ourselves that Baruch Hashem, our kids aren't orphans, but when we change the diapers, we are doing a mitzvah. And as a mother, that means that my responsibility to the home and to the kids, that's something I have to do. And my tefillah, even if I'm going to go with the more stringent opinions, which is not my tradition, even if you learned in seminary or whatever, that there's a greater obligation than what I said, even that opinion of the Chafetz Chaim is only if you really can do it, not at the expense of the mitzvot you're obligated to. If a woman's going to run her life and be very pressured to get in her shachris and her mincha, and then everyone pays the price for that, so that was not the idea. And that's why I was told that Chafetz Chaim's own wife did not daven, because practically you run a house, you don't really have the time. So whatever you can get in, it's good. And sometimes it's good to get in a few minutes of meaningful tefillah, or I should say a few seconds of meaningful tefillah, because a person should connect to their bon shalom during the day. There's a joke they tell of a guy who goes to his friend and he says, "You know, last night I had a dream." He says, "You know, they say you dream at night what you thought about during the day. So what was your dream?" He says, "Very strange. The Ribbono Shel Olam appeared to me in my dream. So he says, well, for sure you didn't think about him all day, so why would that happen? And that can happen, that a person can run a whole day, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is really not in his day all day. So a person taking the few seconds to have a meaningful moment with the Ribbono Shel Olam, which sometimes is that moment of frustration, Ribbono Shel Olam helped me not kill these kids. But if it's meaningful, if it's a moment of connection, so that's important. Meaning, the Ribbono Shel Olam should be a part of our day. The idea that a woman isn't as obligated in davening does not mean that a woman should leave that part of her life irrelevant. The next question which came up. The next question was about meat and milk and an oven, and when you bake something in a meat oven, can you eat it with a cup of coffee? So there are really two questions here. There's the question of our dishes, the pots and the pans that we use, and then there's the question of our oven, which are really two different questions. So maybe we'll begin with the dishes. That's something which is, I translated a chart that we once sent out in Hebrew. I don't know if there are enough copies here. If someone didn't get, they could email us. And we'll go over what this says. And you'll notice we break it down to Ashkenazi and Sephardi. Let's begin with understanding what's really going on here. We have a pot. We cook in that pot our cholent. Okay, so it's our meat pot. We know that. If on Matzei Shabbos I clean out the cholent, and now I fill that pot with water, and I cook the water in that pot. So until Matzei Shabbos, I had cholent in that pot. I cleaned out the pot. Now I put fresh water in that pot, and I cook it. So being that within the last 24 hours, that pot was used for meat, that pot is called Ben Yomo. Within the last day, within the last 24 hours, it was used for meat, in our case. When I cook water in that pot, my assumption is that the water absorbs the flavor of the meat that was cooked in the pot. So where does this come up? You want to make parv potatoes. You want to make rice. You're going to make a parv soup. So if you're using a pot that was used within the last 24 hours for meat. So that's our first thing on the chart. So now, if I intend to melt cheese on this rice or on these potatoes, if I intend to take this pasta and cook it again with milk, if I intend to take these potatoes and sauté, recook them in a dairy pot, if I'm going to put them on a plate with... when they're hot, I'm going to put them in a milchic meal, so I'm going to put them on my dairy dishes. So I don't lechatchila cook them in my meat pot. Meaning, when I know that my meat pot is a ben yomot, was used in the last 24 hours, then I don't cook food in that pot when I intend to bring it in contact with milk, when that's my intention. Now, what happens if I meant to eat my potatoes plain? I didn't mean to eat them with cheese. And then my kids say, "Hey, the potatoes are yummier with cheese, with sour cream." So an Ashkenazi can't do that. If by mistake it got mixed, it's kosher. But I can't say, "Well, I didn't mean to do it, so now I can eat it with dairy." For a Sfardi, you could, so long as a Sfardi didn't intentionally do it for that. A Sfardi could eat it with milk. So that's a big difference between Sfardim and Ashkenazim and a Ben Yomo. So again, when my pot was used within the last 24 hours and I cook parv in that pot, so I cannot do it with the intention, nor may I eat it with dairy. That's on a Ben Yomo. It was used in the last 24 hours. But maybe I have a pot that had cold cholent sitting in it for the last 3 days. It's Tuesday night, and I realize no one's finishing that cholent. I clean out the pot, and now I'm going to make rice in that pot. Now I have a clean pot, a fleshik pot, that's an eino ben yomo. It wasn't used in the last 24 hours. So now I'm going to cook parv soup in that pot. So I'm not allowed to do it with the intention. Let's say I'm going to make a soup and put in pieces of cheese. I'm going to cook my rice and sprinkle cheese or eat it with sour cream. So I'm not allowed to do it with the intention. I can't make something in that pot that I'm going to eat with milk. However, if I didn't intend to do it, and then my intention was to eat parv potatoes. After I cooked the potatoes, I decided I want it with sour cream. I want to eat it with milk. That's mutar even for an Ashkenazi. A Sephardi could even do it with the intention. So again, on an eino ben yomo, on a pot that wasn't used in the last 24 hours, I can't intentionally cook parv food with the intention of eating it with dairy. However, after I cooked it, if I want to eat it with dairy, now I'm allowed to. And a Sephardi could even do it intentionally. So ben yomo, if the pot was used in the last 24 hours, even after I cooked it, I can't eat it with dairy. And an eino ben yomo, I'm talking to Ashkenazim primarily, I think. And an eino ben yomo, if the pot was not used in the last 24 hours, so then, if after I cooked it with a pyre of intention, I want to eat it with milk, I'm allowed to. That's in a nutshell what's written over here. I did not discuss davar harif, sharp things like sliced onions, things that take out flavor. That's its own topic. And obviously you just reverse everything we just discussed for a dairy pot eating with meat. It's the same concept. Yeah?
Okay. You're talking now about actually eating the food together.
Correct.
Yeah. But in the ben yomo, if you have one and you're swallowed by the other.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Right. And you're not fleishik when you eat it.
Of course.
You don't become fleishik.
No.
You stay part of it.
Yeah.
In your example for that, you said if you clean the pot on Tuesday night and then use it, then you said if you're not using the pot, you mean boiled something in the pot? So if you didn't use the pot in 24 hours.
If I didn't heat up fleishik in the pot in the last 24 hours. Yeah. So long as I didn't heat up fleishik, it did not absorb the meat flavor in the last 24 hours. Chazal told us that after 24 hours, the flavor that's absorbed becomes noten tam nifgam, becomes pungent. Provided that I did not cook in it now something sharp. If I'm going to cook an onion inside, that already brings back the original flavor. That's davar harif brings back the original positive flavor. So even on an eino ben yomo pot, if you're going to saute onions on your frying pan or on your pot, and you'll say, but I'm making onion soup. Right, but that onion soup is, let's say, in a fleishik pot, it's fleishik. Because the davar harif, the sharp food, bring out the original flavor. So the whole concept that we're discussing here is only with something that's not a davar harif. If we're already touching on davar harif, okay? So davar harif includes hot peppers, includes horseradish, includes onions and garlic. And when a davar harif has two unique things. One is that when you cook it or fry it, so it brings out the original positive flavor even on an eino ben yomo, even if the pot wasn't used in the last 24 hours. The other thing a davar harif does is what's called duchka de sakina. If I use a knife to cut my onion, and I use a dairy knife, so now my onion absorbs dairy flavor, even though everything was cold. If I use a meat knife to cut my onion or garlic, so my onion or garlic absorb a meat flavor. Now I'm not allowed to use them in the, if I used a meat knife, I'm not allowed to use it in a dairy dish. So that's the concept of davar harif. When I cut something sharp, so then, even if I was using everything cold, and I haven't used that knife for anything in the last 24 hours, I still say that the sharp food brings out the flavor that was in the knife. And that's why when we cut onion and garlic, we should cut them with a parv knife on a parv cutting board, so that our onion and garlic remain parv. Later on, you'll decide to put it in cholent. It'll go in cholent. You'll decide to put it in your lasagna. It'll go into the lasagna. But we try to keep it parv, and if we didn't keep it parv, we should label it as such. You shouldn't have a fleishik onion you cut with a fleishik knife. You shouldn't have that sitting in your fridge not labeled, because you might remember and your kids won't remember, your husband won't remember. It should be labeled if it's not going to be. Then ideally, we try to keep it parv. We do try to keep our things parv. We cut davar harif. We cut sharp things with a parv knife on a parv cutting board. Okay, so yeah.
Back to before davar harif.
Okay.
Okay, if you leave something cold in a dish, let's say in a pava dish, for 25 hours?
Right.
Does that make the dish itself not so fleishik?
Call and ask. We won't go there now.
Okay, I went there because we talked about not just Well, you talked about a pot that wasn't right. You didn't just say, okay, you used it 2 days ago. You said, but you had the stuff sitting there the whole time.
Right, right. It deserves a long answer. I want to cover other more basic things. I don't even want to go into that concept. If people will want, down the road, we could go into it. It's, let's leave that hanging for now. The next thing which we have to discuss is an oven. Okay. Should we speak about lighter things first? Is it too much at one shot? Or should we go with the beginning of the night? It's the same topic. Okay. Do you have an oven tray that you feel comfortable taking out?
Of course.
Not of course. Yeah, the ones that fit in the oven. I'm asking for this. That's perfect. I'm asking for this because I got a Shaila by WhatsApp, and I thought he was talking about one thing, and this keeps happening. Okay, so this is like a shelf of an oven, right? So when we speak about an oven tray, we're talking about this. Now,
not the reshet, not the metal.
That's okay.
I have the same.
You want to bring that out too?
Yeah. I have this, but without the height.
Well, I have
right.
It's
flat. Well, that's the same.
It's called. There's this.
Like, I have something like this. This this.
Hold on.
No,
no, no. But you're baking a cake.
This is
the cake
right.
Go on this.
Yes.
Like that's a rack.
That's a rack.
This is a pan.
I need all of them. That's why. No, I realized that.
This is what you put like a cake on, or like a pan that you're baking something in the going.
You put the baking pan there. Yeah.
Whereas this, I put like if I put some paper on, like I'm making cookies.
This so is what I make, do.
Well, this is chalavi, but it's a stitch every one.
This is cool.
Yeah, I put paper and then I put the challah
in
this. Yeah.
So I put my challahs in a tray, and everyone's different. It's
everyone's different. That's why I need to show and tell, right?
You put baking paper. Yeah, that's it.
I don't know if that matters, but like if I'm making a cake and a pan would. But some people would put it on this.
Yeah, I'll do that. This is paper.
Okay.
Can I have one more? Thank you.
This is a Pyrex.
This
fine.
Is glass.
So glass from our end is the same. We don't treat glass differently.
Okay.
Okay. So the only time we treat glass differently, we'll skip to the end already, is on glass cups because you don't cook in them. But any glass that goes in the oven, like a Pyrex or a Duralex from our end, we have Fleishik, Milchik, and Parv, and even Sfardim, everyone, we have separate glass dishes for things that get heated in the oven. The only time that most people will use the same glass for Fleishik and Milchik and Parv is, really, Milchik and Parv, is the glass you drink in because that's a cliché, you're not cooking in it. So a glass cup, and here we don't differentiate between Duralex and Pyrex, etc., even though they are very different. One's made of lead, etc. However, in glass that you are using, not directly in the heat of a fire, so there, the minig is that you'll take the same glass cup and drink tea at your Fleishik Shabbos table, and then last night you drank a cup of coffee with it, even though that's dairy and that's meat, but you didn't cook in it. Hungarians don't do that. Hungarians don't have the same.
Hungarians doesn't do that.
Hungarians don't bring a Fleishik and Milchik the same glass.
To the table, that's
yeah,
true.
I don't know what your parents do. No, Hungarians don't do it, but many Ashkenazim do use the same glass cups because you're not really you're not heating in that glass. So it's always going to be a cliché, meaning you're never cooking in that glass. So yeah.
If you microwave water in that glass, then that would be a different halacha.
Right. If you're heating in it, then you run in. Then you should have separate for fleishik and milchik and dairy. Yeah.
What about a dishwasher?
Oh. Wait. Let's finish.
Separated dishwashers.
Let's stay where we are.
Slowly.
Let's start slowly. Dishwasher has so many questions I have to ask you before I answer. Let's stay here again. Cool. Okay, so now we're dealing with our oven tray. Okay, so some oven trays look like this. Some oven trays are what we call a reshet. What do you call this in English?
Rack.
And some oven trays are deep, so they actually, you can bake a cake in them. In Israel, this is what's common. Many people actually bake their cakes in this. Now, one of the things I learned in these halachot, just might interest you, is that when you're baking a cake, and you bake it on this, so so the disposable tins aren't so thick, and then the bottom of your cake doesn't bake as well. However, if you bake the cake on this, then the heat spreads out, because you're not over here, you don't really have equal heat, and then the top will burn, and the bottom, I never told you this, I know.
I know, I just said you were like, and I know you be always
been told. Okay.
We got to learn a lot together.
Yeah, everyone here is learning.
So, okay, so now when we deal with our oven tray, maybe we'll start with what people don't know, and then we'll move on to what people do know. No, we'll go the other way. We'll go the other way. So, let's start with a simple case. You want to cook a parv cake in your oven. Mm-hmm. There are many shitot about how to do this. My tradition is very stringent, and we will not learn it. What I'm going to discuss is the commonly accepted halacha all over the world. Those who want to be machmir, there are plenty of shitot to be machmir. What we're going to discuss is what most people do and what most opinions hold is kosher. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, this is the accepted opinion. Rav Moshe was exceptional in how machmir he was in regards to ovens. I don't see any reason to go into that. We will stick to what is commonly accepted as halacha with regards to ovens. Those of you who specifically go by Rav Moshe Feinstein, well, then that's a separate conversation. So let's begin. I have an oven. I have my oven trays. Ideally, we should have separate oven trays for dairy, for meat. And we have a meat oven and a dairy oven, and we should have a separate tray for meat or parv. What if I don't do that? I never heard this before. So we'll discuss that a little bit later. We'll discuss either one. This thing or this thing. Any one of these that you're going to make challah on. So, okay, we'll start there. Fine. I want to leave that for last. Okay, so we'll start there, and I'll explain why I'm saying what I'm saying and how to get around it, and then we'll come back to what the original question was. What's the issue with this rack? The issue is that when you cook chicken, the chicken spills, and you have the heat of the oven, and basically what you have is a very fleishik rack. All of these things, assuming they're fleishik, are very fleishik. And the reason they're fleishik is because in reality, if you're making, let's say, in the dairy oven, you're making pizza, the pizza spills, and the heat element is opposite it, and it's sizzling on the rack, or tray, whatever you want to call these shelves, they are very fleishik or milchik. They are not, when we speak about an oven being used for parv, we're talking about the oven, but not the shelves. Mm-hmm. The shelves, and the same is true for Pesach. People want to use the leniency that Rav Bochka wrote about, that you could kasher an oven for Pesach, and I asked Rav Bochka, and then he pointed this out, and he wrote about it, and then he publicized it again, that everything he wrote was not about the racks, not about the shelves. Because the shelves, you baked challah here. So it absorbed directly from the challah. The only way to kasher this for Pesach is to put a blowtorch to it, and it won't blast the blowtorch. It can't handle a blowtorch. So what do? We want to use this. So we want to use our trays for making parv. You want to make parv cookies in your fleishik oven, and you want to eat them, right? With chocolate chips and milk, right? Chocolate chip cookies with milk, right? So how do you get to parv? So what I wanted to start with, which we're going to wait with for now, is how do I make the whole oven parv? But the tray, I can't make parv. I can't make it parv because I'm always going to have a little bit of grease that's spilled, and baking paper isn't considered a separation between the tray and the food. And this is one of the least known halachos which are relevant to every housewife. People don't know this. And everyone should know this. Our baking tray is problematic in the sense that that cannot become parv. So how do I get around that?
I have another question.
Wait. Let's finish and then we'll get to it. How do I get around that? I have separate trays for parv and fleishik or milchik, or what I could do is the following. I could take two disposable tins. You can get disposable tins that are the size of your tray. And then I could bake in that. Everything I want should be parved. Why does that help me? Because if I have grease that's all over here, If I were to use one disposable tin, then the grease gets absorbed into the disposable tin, and from there into my challah. If I have an oven, what I have here is I have an oven tray rack shelf, which sometimes has meat grease on it. If it's my dairy one, sometimes it has oil from pizza or cheese or whatever you put there. So if I want to make something tarv, if I were to put only one tin, disposable tin on it, so then the grease that's here would get absorbed into my tray and from my tray into my food. So when I have two tins, so we have a concept in halacha that says, "Ein kli bolem mikli b'lo rotev." One vessel cannot absorb from another vessel when there's no liquid in between them. So if I have two disposable tins, even if it got absorbed to the first one, it won't go to the second one. Because it won't transfer, flavor won't transfer from one vessel to another vessel. It doesn't matter how hot they get, so long as there's no liquid in between the vessels. So if the...
So it has to be dry?
Mm-hmm. Should be dry, yeah.
So if you have two the same size, which I just cup into the other one.
That's fine.
And that'll still
that's
be enough.
Fine. Yeah.
It only counts if you're cooking directly on the tray.
So correct.
But the baking tray is
not enough. Right. Let's go one step at a time.
You're making the chicken.
Yeah, but if I make the chicken in a metal casserole on a pyrex.
Okay, so I'm making chicken on here.
Yeah.
And my chicken spills. If not on Sunday, then on Monday. If not when I do it, when my husband does it. But it spills, right?
Yeah, that's so spilling.
I have chicken grease on my trays.
Okay.
Now, if I'm going to take a parv tray, cookie tray, I want to make parv cookies, and I put it on the grease. So some people told me, are you kidding? We take out the tray every day. We take Sano, we clean it all. It's spick and span. I don't know. It was the first time I ever heard of such people. I think most people don't run their houses that way. I'm saying reality is you have grease that cooks that gets stuck and you don't have time. In the day-to-day, the average person on their tray, they have this cook and that cook. So we don't lechatchila take a parv cookie sheet or my parv halos and put them down on chicken grease and then say, well, my oven is parv. The whole concept of making the oven parv works with vis-a-vis the whole oven. But my tray that has little spots of chicken oil or fat or whatever it is on it, and it doesn't help that I put baking paper. If I want to, I could put tin foil, two layers. But realistically, tin foil tears. And that's why I didn't give that option initially. If you want to get that really thick tin foil that you use on Pesach, it's not a practical solution. That tin foil cuts your hand every time, the edges of it are sharp. It's not a really good solution. A better solution is to take two disposable tins, get them the size of your thing, buy the good ones, in big deal they usually have the really thick ones, get the good ones and use them for 2 or 3 years. Now you're going to use it for 2 or 3 years, title it. It's not disposable anymore. A disposable tin, which you're using for 2 or 3 years, is not a disposable tin anymore. You have to title that. However, once you have two, you label those two. This is my parv one. Now, you'll notice that the lower one has grease on the bottom after a month. You don't care. That's why you have two. You don't have to spend your time cleaning that bottom one. You know that bottom one is going to get greasy. That's exactly why you're taking two, so that the bottom one can get greasy and the next one will remain clean and the flavor doesn't go from one to the other and you're fine. And then you can make your parv challah and your parv cookies and you've just replicated your shelf. Now, again, if I have grease over here and I put baking paper, so then my assumption is that the flavor goes through the baking paper to my food, to my cookies, to my challahs. I can't assume it's parv. If I am going to put one layer of tin foil, is it going to tear? Maybe not. Maybe you're really good, but when you peel off the cookies, the first time will tear, the second time you haven't accomplished that much. So the more practical idea is to take two disposable tins and put them on your baking tray. So that's in terms of our baking tray. Now we'll talk about our oven after we take a few questions. Yeah.
Okay, you keep making the point that the foil pan is going to be the same size as the tray. Does it have to be?
No, just if people are going to use this little tin, they're going to say I ruined their kitchen for them. I want people to be able to bake as much as they want. I'm saying realistically, it's more practical if people get the right measurement. It's a one-time investment, and then you've replicated your tin. If you're going to just get a small one, then the day will come when you suddenly want to make three challahs, and you won't have that. And then you're going to start working with tin foil. You could put two layers of tin foil. You could do that. It's just a little tedious, and then to make sure it doesn't tear. And it's just I'm trying to give a practical long-term solution. When we speak about how to run a kitchen, so part of our goal is that things don't mess up, that we set it up in a way that in the long run it works. You're right, we could do that.
So yeah. Make it easy, buy a second one and use it as a park.
So that's easy and expensive. They sell these very, very expensive,
really?
Meaning if they come with your oven.
We had one that tricked us across the street together, it was like 200 shekels.
Right.
Oh, really?
It's really ridiculous.
It almost pays to buy a new oven.
But,
I'm saying it's so expensive each one.
I didn't notice that they are so
expensive.
Yeah.
Correct. Unless you have a self-cleaning oven. Self-cleaning oven is its own conversation. But how many times are you going to make that self-cleaning oven self-clean? We're not discussing Pesach yet. Let's saying if we'll have no, look, Pesach is its own conversation.
Yeah. Does the bottom tray really have to be titled? You're not cooking food.
The bottom tray would not. You're right. If you keep the bottom, you're right.
You have to keep the bottom.
Yeah, you need because it's attached to Pesach.
You're right. You're right. The bottom one would not.
But once you're already pulling the total one, you really can't take that other one.
But the ones
you also have to remember
have to
you didn't title it.
Right?
That's what they say. Yeah.
That's
that's what the Vadat says. That if it has their hechsher, but those are the flimsy ones, aren't they?
Yeah, the ones that you're talking about are the American toilets.
And they're much better.
Yeah.
But the bigger ones,
they have a badat, so you need to toilet them?
I don't think so. I think the badat says you don't have to. Yeah.
You need not to toilet them, or you need to... Yeah.
So I usually bake on this with either, let's say, if it's cookies on a tray like this. Just cake and something like this. I bake in my dairy oven because I always think I'm often going to have cake with coffee. And if I have dessert, it's after the plation meal anyhow.
Okay.
Am I wrong in my calculations?
We're not yet up to that. We'll get there.
Okay. This is,
I haven't yet discussed that.
We all have things. We do things a certain way, too. This is just for the Malchaga. We all do things, and the question is, am I doing this right, or am I doing this wrong all these years?
No,
we have this why, and I feel like I need to make sure that I'm doing it.
We're going to get to it in 1 second. That's where I wanted to start.
I have my reasons why, but I just want to make sure I'm not messing it up.
Is that a separate tray?
Huh? What?
Like the tray.
This I put on my rack. This is like a cookie sheet.
You put this on the rack.
I put it on the rack.
Right, but okay. So if we could take
this
for a second. Okay, so that here's my milchik oven, and I have all kinds of little grease marks from the pizza and whatever I heated up here. If I take my parv tray and put it on here. So my parv tray isn't parv anymore.
Yeah.
It becomes melted.
Because what did I just do? I'm saying I took my parv tray and I put it on cheese oil.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's why I should have something else that goes in between.
It's not saying literally. I always bake in my chalavi oven, but I always thought that this was parv. So now you're telling me that this is really dairy.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that.
No,
because there's a longer answer.
To have the reasons why I feel like you eat baked goods with coffee.
I'm not saying halacha lemaisa, that deserves a different answer.
Okay.
We're discussing how to run a kitchen.
Okay.
You're asking me whether that is dairy, that deserves a separate answer. No. We're saying on a conceptual level, the way we run our kitchen is to ensure we don't reach a point where that becomes dairy.
Okay.
Are you asking now, is it dairy? That's its own question. I'm saying it's a different question. So let's start again.
You're saying when you want your oven now, you should do it. Not.
I'm saying in terms of here moving forward, so we should have a separation between our parv tins and our racks. Ideally, we should have separate racks for meat and parv, or dairy and parv. A lot of people don't. We didn't get that many racks with our oven. We don't have that. I'm saying so the way to do it is to have another separation. So if, let's say, I have a cooking sheet like that rack that goes on this rack, right? So then I would put tin foil here and then my cooking sheet. I've accomplished the same thing. My point is that I have two vessels whereby the vessel which I'm putting my cookies on is not in contact with my rack that's filthy. And we all have racks that are dirty. I'm saying realistically, it's not. What we're discussing now is how to run the kitchen. Now, I anticipate many people will be calling tonight and saying, wait a second, now what about all my cookie sheets? Are they fleishig, milchig, or par? That's another question. Now, what did I do and what my cookie sheets are? That's a different question than our question now of how to run a kitchen. But when we run the kitchen, our trays, ideally our racks, should be separate, dairy, meat, and par. And the way to keep, and if I don't have separate racks for par, then I need to have a separation between my rack, my shelf, whatever you want to call this, and my par food. And if I'm going to bake a cake inside this rack, right? So we have a very deep rack. So my cake over here is like my pot. Yeah. Benyomo, not benyomo. Assuming I got it clean, all the rules we discussed earlier are now relevant for my rack, whatever you call this, I don't know what you call this in English, my baking pan, right? This shelf that's a pan, it becomes like a pot, right? If I baking paper won't help me here. Yes?
I've been very careful about this because I haven't had a chance to ask. When you take something out of the oven, because I now have a meat oven and a parv oven, and you put it on top of the stovetop because it's boiling hot, now that's a huge issue, right?
I'll explain what she just said. But really, we should do this. Can I borrow part of your stovetop? Because I
yes, it's so good. We're doing it in the house. Thank you. Really? Yeah. No, because again, someone sent in a shayla last week, and they
didn't
have
the they were talking about one thing, and they were really talking about something else.
Not okay. Always, but luckily for the demonstration, we're doing well.
So we have this.
The laws are coming tonight. So we have
in Hebrew, this is called the chatzuva. This is the what's this called in English? In English, it's called what?
The grate.
The grate, right? Okay, so the grate that all the pots sit on. Well, ideally, Rav Soloveitchik wanted people to have separate grates and separate flames for dairy and meat. I don't know anyone that does this, but there were many rabbis who asked that people do it, and I've never heard of anyone who does it. Practically, most people don't have enough flames or don't feel like they have enough flames. But in reality, I don't know of any house that runs the way that's written in Rav Pfeiffer's book, in Rav Soloveitchik, etc. Bottom line, everyone uses the same flame for meat and milk, and it spills. Sometimes things spill. So the oil, the gravy, whatever I have over here, this is the one place in the house, the stove top, that's not kosher. Meaning the rest of our house should be kosher. The stove top we know is not kosher. We know that meat and milk spill here. We have meat, you know, you make latkes and the oil splashes all over here, the dairy oil. You make pancakes, so this gets dairy. And then you make soup, you make chonk, whatever you make, it spills on here. So this gets absorbed, and this also has oils which are dairy and meat mixed together. Now you'll tell me it's not edible. Right, most of the time it's not edible, but you don't know how much you have and how much not. So our rule is that anything that touches here, any food item, you know, if you dropped some noodles on your stovetop, or if you dropped some noodles onto here, or if you had a latke that fell onto here, you don't need it. From our end, it's not kosher. Our assumption is that everything here is not kosher. You have meat and milk grease mixed together, and this absorbs from the heat, meat and milk. So one person wanted to argue, but there's a fire that's always kashering this. Right, but this gets hot and the fire isn't kashering it. Meaning it's not a correct way to look at it. He's right, and Shulchan Aruch says what he said. Meaning he's right, that technically wherever the fire goes, the fire cleans it. But the fire doesn't get everywhere, and a lot of it gets hot, and the fire doesn't clean it. So the maisa, we assume the whole top, our whole grate, and our stovetop are not kosher. And therefore, we do not place food here. And we do not place, if any food falls onto this or the stovetop, we don't need it. We don't, that has to get discarded.
Is that only if someone's used it for meat and dairy?
Yeah.
If you've never used it for dairy, it's fine.
Right. If you've never used it for dairy, it's fine.
Then it's literally everything's...
Let's go back to our oven. Let's go back to our oven. So now we're all set up. Okay, we want to make parv, we want to make chocolate chip cookies, we want to make challah, and we have our oven rack, tray, whatever you want to call this, and I've lined it, or I've put two trays on it, or I have a parv oven rack, and I want to bake parv in my oven. So what do I do? So the first thing I need to do is make sure I don't have gravy or pieces of chicken sitting around the oven, right? I'm not supposed to be making parv in an oven. I'm heating up the oven. If I still have gravy that's bubbling and that's giving off a good smell, the last time I made chicken, it splattered all over. Now when I turn on the oven, I get the smell of chicken still in the house, so my oven is still flashing. So the first thing we do is we heat up the oven. If we turn up the oven to its highest heat, and we wait for the thermostat to turn off, and as far as I know, I don't have anything bubbling there. I don't have any serious spills of chicken gravy. I don't have a puddle of chicken soup or whatever on my trays. So I turn it on, and when I see the thermostat went off, that means I've reached that heat, what we call libun kal. And what I've accomplished is that my oven has just become parv. And now if I want to put in a parv cake, open, so then my cake will be parv. Meaning when I turn on the oven to the highest heat, assuming I don't have pieces or juice or anything that gives a good smell, if I do, then I have to wait till it burns out, which can take a little bit of time, by the way. You're better off cleaning it. If you know you have a little puddle of chicken soup, you can wait an hour before that really burns out in the oven. So you're better off cleaning it. But at any rate, once I don't have any bi'en, I don't have any real substance here, even if I've used it in the last 24 hours, this is the opinion of many of the poskim, so then I have made my oven parv, and now I can make something which is completely parv, which I'll be able to eat with milk and cheese and whatever. So if I want to make challah should be parv. We don't make flejik or milchik challah, right? Or if I want to make anything else that will be completely parv. So the way I accomplish that is by A, ensuring my tray isn't flejik. So we said I'm going to have two layers for that. Or I have a parv tray. And B, I want the oven to be parv. How do I make the oven parv? I turn it to its highest heat. There are opinions, good opinions in halacha, that hold that if you haven't used your oven in the last 24 hours, and as far as you know, there isn't any gravy or anything in the oven, so then you don't even have to turn it to its highest heat. That's two opinions as to when it's an eino ben yomo, when it hasn't been used in the last 24 hours, do you still have to put it on its highest heat? Usually it doesn't cost us a lot, you know, you're going to turn on that oven anyways, so turn it on before you put the food in. You've accomplished another opinion. But this only works for the oven. It doesn't kasher my trays. My trays, which had food directly on them, the rest of the oven has steam that goes into the walls. But the trays, they absorb directly when food spills on them. On my trays, I'm going to be putting food, like challahs and chocolate chip cookies. So my trays, that doesn't work for it. But for the rest of the oven, it does kasher the rest of the oven and make it parv. So that whatever I'm going to be making in the oven at this point will be parv. Yes?
So you have let's say, your milk oven, you've now kashered to be parv. You have your milk tray, and you put it...
Wait, milk is a little bit tricky. I'll explain why.
The fleshix.
But milk ovens very often have a lot of real food on the bottom. Because very often, you know, it depends on what oven you have. But the fleshik is more likely to... If you can keep your milchik without real food, that's fine.
It's not but, really relevant to me, but I'm trying to figure
out... No, I should say also fleshik, because I've seen people who only had a little toaster oven, and they broil their chicken there. And when you look at the bottom of the toaster oven, there's plenty of real juice down there. I'm saying it sort of depends on how you run your oven. This works in reality when there's no real food there that's bubbling. Meaning,
my question is, you've got the oven has been kashered,
yeah,
and you have the triple tray so that the top tray is parva.
Fine.
But meantime, you have your multi sulfation bottom tray in your now parva oven, and this doesn't to make the oven rack to be multi sulfation.
To make the oven rack? I didn't follow.
No, to turn the oven back into being multi sulfation.
No, the reason the oven turns milchik or fleshik is because of the steam the food gives off.
And this, whatever grease, whatever's on the bottom.
So we said you heat it to the point where you don't see any liquid bubbling. I said that before. There shouldn't be, it doesn't matter where, anywhere in the oven, there should not be neither real food be'en nor liquid that's bubbling. If I have gravy that's bubbling, then my oven is not yet parv. I cannot have, that's what I said in the beginning, that if you have a little pool of gravy on your tray, you should really wipe it off before you start, because it can take you a little bit of time till you reach the point that it's so dry that it's not bubbling. The assumption is, if there's only a little bit, a smatter here and there, that's almost not bubbling to begin with. By the time you turned on your oven, you don't smell anything, okay, you could move on.
So what I do in my oven, I put always aluminum foil down on the bottom, and I take it out when I'm finished with the meat. Because as you say, something, the thing drops, so it doesn't drop on my oven, it doesn't...
Okay.
So that's okay. So I don't need to clean it so much, because it's on the aluminum foil and I throw it away.
So long as what we see, we don't see anything. I'm saying we don't have to worry that maybe in some corner in the back there's a little puddle. That I don't have to worry about.
Okay.
Okay. So with that, we basically finished our discussion of kashrut on dishes and in terms of our pots and our pans and cooking parv and baking parv. And now we move on to all the other exciting questions that are here. They're really interesting questions. So... do you have to give tzedakah to every person who asks? No. Okay. What do you say when they come to your door and you don't have cash? You say, I can't right now. No, you don't have to tell them you don't have cash. You could just say, right now it doesn't work for us. I would add that the halacha assumes that there's a certain relationship between a husband and wife, and that there's a certain amount that we feel every husband wants his wife to feel comfortable spending, and there's a certain amount where the expectation within a marriage is that we talk about it before we spend that amount. It's interesting that husbands are bad at this. But lemaisa, coming back to here, it's I'm saying very often the wife says, shouldn't we have discussed that before you spent that money on a new car or whatever? Okay, but bottom line, that the halacha does assume that before you're going to give a sizable amount, there's going to be a conversation. So, true story, about 20 years ago in California, there's a place called Hancock Park. So the Rav needed, he was fundraising for Kimcha de Pisa to buy the poor matzahs. So he went to one of his members' houses, and the wife answered the door. She said her husband's on a business trip. He said, "You know, we're trying to put together money to buy the poor matzahs. Is there something you could check with your husband? How much you should give?" So she says to him, "I'll just check what cash we have around the house, and whatever it is, I'll give you." And she comes back with $28,000. True story. So she says, "Here." So he didn't know what to do, right? You know, this was the cash they had lying around the house. So he took it and waited. And he did what the halacha says you're supposed to do. He called the husband and he said, "Look, you weren't around. So your wife gave me $28,000. Now that's not the amount you usually give for Kimcha de Pisa." And the husband was very nice. The husband said, "If that's what my wife gave, it's all going for tzedakah, use it." But that's halacha, that there's a certain amount, there's a range that every house has their range, that it's understandable between a husband and wife that the wife should do as she sees fit when people come to the door. What that range is has to be decided with each couple. If 28,000 wasn't the number, then it's clear to me that 5,000 in that house was the number, meaning for $5,000 he didn't care. 28,000 was more than he expected. Okay, that's not what our houses run like. At our houses, you have to see what given your budget, what's acceptable between in the way you run the house. However, there are two aspects in tzedakah. One is, okay, there are multiple aspects. We'll start with one. If someone comes to us and it's pikuach nefesh, someone comes and says, "I'm hungry, I need to eat." So you bring them two slices of bread. It says that when there's room to think, there's pikuach nefesh, there you don't take the time to start checking, is the guy telling the truth? So many times I've had people stop me in the street and tell me I'm hungry. My kids are hungry at home. And I always say the same thing, "Come, we'll find the closest makolet, I'll buy you a loaf of bread." And they say, "No, my kids like this cereal and that cereal." Mm-hmm. And I say, no, I don't buy that for my kids. You want, your kids are hungry, I'll get you a loaf of bread." And except for once, every other time, the people just walked away. They never went with me to the makolet to get a loaf of bread. But I was fulfilling the halacha. The halacha says But if someone tells you they're hungry, so you can't assume you have the time to check out whether they're legitimate or not. So you get them food. But food, I've given them my sandwich, my lunch. Said, you're hungry? Here, take my lunch. I don't have to give them money, but I can't ignore a person who tells me they're hungry with the assumption maybe he's a charlatan. However, when it comes to my money, so there I should really know where I'm giving tzedakah to. And this is where the halacha breaks down into two things. On the one hand, we're supposed to be giving people. And that's what the Rambam writes, that if you have an opportunity to give 100 times to 100 different people, that's better than giving one person 100 shekel. Because as we get accustomed to giving, we become giving people, and that's a good custom. On the other hand, you do want to have an impact with your tzedakah money. And this is a balancing act that every family has to figure out. The next question was asked, is it acceptable to make judgments on the cause? Everyone has to make judgments. We make judgments. However, the halacha has 24 levels of decision of how to give tzedakah. Your siblings come first, your own family, your own relatives, your own neighbors. A person who doesn't have what to eat comes before a person who needs money to buy himself a Cadillac. Meaning there are different levels in tzedakah, and it's one of the shaitas that come up every month. It's highly recommended. You sit down with the Rav and figure out how you want to allocate your tzedakah. A person once came that he had a large sum of money that he wanted to give to tzedakah. And I said to him, do you have relatives who need it? So he thought for a minute and he said, no. I said, does your wife have relatives who need it? So he looks at me and says, they're my relatives too. We have a responsibility to our family first. So and people sometimes run to get tzedakah and they don't calculate, do they have enough money put aside? Is it right for them to give tzedakah? What about the money they might need if their child needs a root canal or a child needs orthotics or all kinds of needs that our own children, our own family might need? Before a person runs out and invests their tzedakah, it's a good idea to sit down and go over the halachot, because sometimes a person would be more wise to calculate their tzedakah differently. Should everyone give ma'aser? Yeah. How do you calculate ma'aser? That's a very good question. There are many angles as to how we calculate ma'aser. Is it pre-expenses or post-expenses? Is the money you use for your children included in your tzedakah money or not? So there are many angles to be discussed, and that's why it's recommended that people do allocate the money and also sit down with the Rav and figure out what's the proper way to spend their tzedakah money. Yeah?
A question on the side, because I go with it with the family comes first. What is in the case of when you are Georg, that your not-Jewish parents count as family or not?
Some degree, yes. Now, Halacha says, but again, it's recommended to sit down and figure it out with the Rav. But the part of Hilchos Tzedakah is that we give Tzedakah also to non-Jews together with Jews. How much? Mm-hmm. How it should be decided? I had a student once who was a priest. And when he converted to Judaism, his children did not. His wife and children did not. And we would sit together and write Christmas cards. I mean, what could he write and what can't he write? But he had to write. I always told him, your kids are expecting that. So you won't mention what's against the Torah, but you will give them encouragement. You will speak to them about being decent human beings and taking on New Year's pledges. And we would write his Christmas cards together. We would pick the gifts together. It's a good idea to figure out, again, how much and in what venue. Mm-hmm. Does soap need a hechsher? No. Does soap need a hechsher? No. Do disposable dishes need a hechsher? No. What if I use them with boiling hot soup and the soup might melt the bowls a little bit? That's okay. We assume that nothing positive came into your soup and that's fine. The only exception when disposable items need a hechsher is paper goods on Pesach. Paper goods on Pesach sometimes have starch on them. So for Pesach, it's a good idea that everything should have hechsher, but really what really needs it are the paper goods. Can I put soap in a pot and heat up the pot? Yes. Can I pour boiling water into a soapy pot? Yes. Our assumption is that even if the soap does not have a hechsher, no positive non-kosher flavor goes from that soap to your pot. So you don't have to worry. If the way you're going to clean your pot is by boiling it with soap and soapy water and whatever, that's fine. If you want to pour in boiling water on your soap, that's also fine. Can I listen to Jewish music with psukim while cleaning the bathroom? So this is interesting. Shuls have their bathrooms within earshot of the shul. So when you go to the bathroom, you could hear Kriyas HaTorah, you could hear Kaddish, and you have to make sure you're not answering Yehesh Mei Rabba in there, right? You're not allowed to say holy things in a bathroom. So hearing things is not usser. Saying things and thinking things of holiness is usser. Meaning that the isser is for me to think psukim. Now, if while you're cleaning the bathroom, you're going to listen to a song with psukim, and you're going to end up saying those words, then that's not a good idea. Thinking the psukim, I doubt anyone thinks about psukim as they hear the music. But saying the words of the pasuk, that's aser. I'm not allowed to do that in a bathroom. So technically, it's mutter if I have music playing in the background, just like next to a shul. People go to the bathroom and they hear what's going on in the shul. That's okay. So too, if I hear music and they're singing psukim, that's okay. What's not okay is to say the words of psukim or to think the words of psukim. I'm not allowed to think Torah in a bathroom. I'm not allowed to say Torah or brachos or davening or whatever in a bathroom.
How can you be in the bathroom hearing Kaddish or hearing Shema or something without thinking of the psukim?
So that's up to a person to control their thoughts.
Don't go to the bathroom in just time.
That's what the Mishnah Brura says. Do your the Mishnah Brura writes. Do your counting, or read a secular book.
In the shul.
Okay. Look, but it's a reality. Most shuls don't put their bathrooms far enough away that you don't hear it. I'm saying there's a reality.
Because you'll not think the words that you're hearing.
Think about something else.
Right.
Try to think about something else and you accidentally think what you should not say. It's a consolation for anyone with the doors to the bathroom in Ashkenazi shul are very heavy. Yes, it's extremely heavy. You don't hear it. Might chop your children's fingers off so they can't walk. But you're not. So you don't hear it in Ashkenazi shul. You don't hear it. Yeah. Okay, if there is a smell of a dirty diaper, so ideally we don't say blessings next to that.
If you did, then your blessings are fine. Your kiddush is okay. Your benching is okay. What if there's a smell of a dirty diaper, but there is no dirty diaper? Probably one of the older kids isn't clean. What are my limitations? Really none. I'm saying it's no different. If you know anything is going on, fine. But otherwise, we assume that there isn't anything around. If you know one of the older kids had an accident, then it's the same. It's the same as a diaper, really. If we touched on this, let's touch on one other thing that people sometimes overlook, and that is that when a woman's hair is uncovered, then you cannot make blessings. So sometimes comes Havdalah time, just like that there are two things written in the pasuk. One is the area has to be clean, which is there shouldn't be feces or urine in the place where we make blessings or daven. So that's relevant to us when we daven in our kids with diapers. Then in the same area, in Parshas Kiseitze, the Torah discusses the idea that a person shouldn't be uncovered, it includes a man or a woman, shouldn't be uncovered at a time that things of holiness are taking place. So when we daven or make blessings, there's a certain amount of modesty that must be in our area, in our machane, in the place that we see. So if a woman wants to make a bracha or daven and she's wearing a robe, so if there's anything under the robe, that's fine. But there has to be a separation between the heart and a person's private parts. What happens if a person's hair is uncovered, a woman's hair is uncovered? So the custom is that we cover our hair even in the house. But it's a custom, meaning technically if a woman, for whatever reason, is right now without her hair covering in the house, it's only her and her husband or whatever, he can't make Havdalah. This is where it comes up in many houses, that sometimes the wife hasn't covered her hair yet, and the husband is ready for Havdalah, so he can't make Havdalah with her, even though she's his wife, and even though right now they're mutar. Mm-hmm. So that's something that people sometimes overlook. Yeah.
If you are davening, you start Shkona Esrei, and the diaper is good when you start,
right?
And then it becomes not good. What's your best option?
And the kid is next to you.
Of course the kid's next to your dad.
I love it. So the kid is wearing a garment other than the diaper? Or just the diaper?
Usually.
No, okay. If there's a difference, I'll explain. If there's a garment, so then you could choose what works for you. Because there are shitos that say that if it's covered, so then even though you can smell it, you can daven. L'chatchila, we don't rely on that, but you're in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. However, if they're not wearing a garment, so almost always there's a little bit that's like really on the surface of the diaper, right? And there it would be more appropriate to stop your davening, not talk, but stop, clean the diaper, clean your hands, and go back to Shemoneh Esrei. Just remember that there is an opinion that walking without talking is not a hefsek. So we would rely on that opinion. It's a machlokas Shulchan Aruch and Gra in Shulchan Aruch. And here we would rely on that opinion. But you could kiss the child. I'm saying we don't have to be gruff. We just shouldn't talk. If we don't have to, we should really not talk and change the diaper, clean our hands, and go back to Shemoneh Esrei. The next question was, can someone wrap their hands instead of washing for bread? So the halacha describes the following. The halacha says you're traveling and you don't have water easily accessible. How far do you have to go to get water in order to wash, to eat the bread? So the halacha says two things. You have to walk 18 minutes in the wrong direction. That means, let's say you're sitting in your house here and the water stops in Kochav Yaakov. 18 minutes would get you to the edge of Tel Tzion, I think, or an 18-minute walk. So the halacha expects you to leave your house and go all the way there, if you know there's water there, to wash your hands, and then come back and eat your bread. And if it's a longer distance, now, this is a gauge of tircha. How much do I have to work to obtain water and wash my hands? So you'll say, I'm on an 18-hour flight, and there's no water right now to wash my hands. Well, in 5 minutes will you have water? In 10 minutes will you have water? This is a gauge of tircha. How much do I have to invest in order to obtain water? So the concept is 18 minutes out of your way, which is really 36 minutes. It's 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back. And even then, it would only be permissible if you're really hungry. Meaning, then a person is allowed to wrap their hands and eat the bread. What I'm saying now is in Shulchan Aruch. It's not no big chiddush. It's in the laws of washing hands. We know the story of Rabbi Akiva. He was an old man. He was in prison. His Talmud brought him water to drink, and he had water to wash his hands. And the jailer decided there was too much water, so he spilled half the water out. So when he brought the water to Rabbi Akiva, he saw Rabbi Akiva washing his hands before he ate the bread. So he said, Rabbi, your life depends on this water. He says, yeah, and I'm chayav misa if I eat the bread without washing. So I'm going to wash my hands, and I'm not going to forgo what Chazal instituted to wash hands before eating bread. So we're not Rabbi Akiva, but the halacha still says that before we use this leniency of wearing gloves, of wrapping our hands instead of washing for bread, the halacha says it has to be two things. A tircha, that's the equivalent of 18 minutes in the wrong direction, which is, again, 36 minutes. It's 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back. And you have to be really hungry. So sometimes you are, right? There are certain scenarios where you are. Sometimes a woman just gives birth. She's sitting in the hospital bed. She's been in labor for 2 days. She hasn't had anything to eat. And she's not supposed to get out of bed. And she's ravenous. Okay, she thinks to herself, is this equal? If I had to, I'd walk 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back. I am that hungry, that's how I feel. Fine, put on the gloves, make a hamotzi, and enjoy the food. The halacha relies on the person to call that shot. The concept the halacha gives us is that's the level of tircha we have to invest in order to wash before we eat. If I have chicken in the frying pan, am I allowed to pour oil onto the frying pan? So it goes like this. If things are hot, I have hot chicken, I have hot oil, I'm not supposed to pour directly from the bottle because I'm concerned that the steam will come up, I'm concerned things will splash. I'm not supposed to pour directly onto hot fleishik from my cold bottle. And it doesn't matter if I'm pouring onto the chicken or I'm pouring onto the oil that's by the chicken, or I'm pouring into the hot chulent. I don't pour directly from a parv vessel with oil or with water, for that matter. If I want to put more water in my chulent pot, I'm not supposed to pour directly into the hot chulent pot from my parv vessel. What about if I have one of these fancy frying pans that have no oil? So then I'm allowed to pour, even though it's a fleishik frying pan, I'm allowed to pour from my oil onto the pan, so long as I'm not pouring on the chicken. So if I have schnitzel on one side and I want to add oil for whatever reason, and I'm going to pour my oil on an area of the pan which is dry, so that's okay. So I don't pour on hot fleishiks. Okay.
Does that also apply to spices?
Technically, we should put the spices on a spoon or in our hand, and the idea is that the steam comes up into the spices. Yeah, people, the same thing with salt. That's why we try to have a fleishik milchik and a parv salt shaker, because the steam goes up into the salt. You're making soup.
Why do you put it that way? Don't pour from the parv or oil container, rather than say have a fleishik soil and a milchik soil.
Because most people don't have enough room in their cabinet for both. Practically, it doesn't work.
You have two kitchens. Don't stay here with us, okay?
Saying realistically, so what people can do is put it in a cup and pour from the cup inside. Pour it on a spoon and pour it from the spoon inside. But to pour directly once it's hot is a problem. There are two questions here which are important. Can children under the age of bar and bas mitzvah sift flour, tovel dishes, check eggs, check dried fruits, check rice? Okay, so we'll start with sifting flour. The general concept is that children under bar and bat mitzvah, maybe we'll start with what's relevant to them. If a child wants to eat a date, most dates don't have worms, and they're very easy to check. So the halacha trusts a kid when it's something that they can do, they know how to do, and it's not a tircha. Meaning, that's when the halacha trusts a child. So checking a date isn't a big deal. You open the date, you look, you put it up to the sun, they could see, okay. So a child can be trusted to eat his own dates.
From what age?
From the age that you believe them, they know how to do it, and that they will. From the age that it makes sense to you, that they will. Now, what about sifting flour? So our flour, unless you're buying in the natural stores, if you're buying it at our makolet, where there's a high turnover, most of our flour is bug-free. If you know your flour has bugs, then the child can check it. If you're buying regular flour, again, from a regular store that has a high turnover, so then most of the time the flour is really without worms or bugs. So then, if you're next to the child, and you've taught them how to do it, even if you're in and out of the room, they can do it, so long as they know you're overseeing them, and so long as they're sifting, and at the end of sifting, they don't do this. Right? Because then you didn't accomplish anything. If you know that your kid isn't going to do this at the end, or every so often, so you have to make sure you trust the child and that it makes sense. So then, the child should know that they're only doing it with you present. You don't want a situation where they're going to end up making cookies. Hi, Ma, I surprised you. Make cookies for everyone. There has to be, in the child's chinuch, they have to know, I do it when Abba and Ima are next. I mean, the same is true with checking eggs. Our eggs, again, if you're not buying natural eggs, when you're buying natural eggs, then you have to check. Because on natural eggs, you don't know if there are male chickens around the female chickens. On the eggs you buy from Tnuva, the eggs you buy at a store, so our eggs we check, and we have to check, and if we find blood we're not allowed to eat it, but it's much more lenient, because our eggs are from chickens that really grow out without males. So if you have your daughter or son standing next to you, and you've taught them how to check eggs, and you see that they generally know what they're doing, you could let them check eggs next to you. That's okay. So we covered sifting flour, assuming you don't know of the flour being different. We covered checking eggs. Again, when you're next to them and they know you're overseeing what they did. And any food that is the same status, that there isn't a chazaka, you don't have to assume that food is wormy, and it's easy to check. Those are going to be our two criteria. If it's a tircha, so it says in the halachos of Pesach, we can't count on kids to check for chametz, because it's hard work checking for chametz. So we don't rely on the kids for checking for chametz.
But they before bar mitzvah, they can't, and the day after they could.
That's the cutoff point, yeah. In terms of checking rice, if you're next to them and they know what they're doing, so then they can do that. A mother wants to comb her girls' hair on Shabbat, so we need two criteria. Number one, we need a brush that won't tear her hairs. They sell in the stores what's called Nivreshet Seyar, a comb that's made of some animal's hair that I don't want to tell you which animal, but it's not, it doesn't tear her hair, and it should be designated as a Shabbos brush. Now, Halacha says combing hair with a regular brush is uvdan dechol. It's a weekday type activity. So if you're going to do it on Shabbos, do it with something that's designated for Shabbos. Now the question is, should we stop here or continue another 5 minutes?
I'm fine with 5 minutes.
Yeah? Do we have questions? Should we recap or move forward?
Forward?
Toileting dishes for
under children, so long as an adult is present, so long as you're overseeing the child do it.
And they make the well?
Yeah. Things that are publicized in the newspaper, are we allowed to tell them over? Did you hear what they wrote about whoever? So the Chafetz Chaim breaks down Lashon Hara into two things. The one is what we know. We're not allowed to say something that would harm someone else. We're not allowed to speak and say something that's going to harm someone else. That's the obvious one. But the Chafetz Chaim adds another point. And he says that when we say something with evil intent, when there's really nothing positive, there's no good reason why we're saying it, so we're saying it to publicize it, we're saying it to put someone down, you might term it as whenever the Yetzer Hara is involved, so then it's Aser. Meaning the only time we'd be allowed to say something about someone just because it's in the paper is when I have good intentions. The Chafetz Chaim adds the second component, he proves it from the Rambam in the Halacha of Apeit Lasa, that I'm not allowed to say something when my intention is evil. And that's part of our nature, that we do want to say negative about people. It makes us feel better, we put someone else down, however you'll explain it. So I can't have the intention of spreading bad about someone, I can't have the intention of harming someone, I can't have any bad intentions. And that's why what they say in the yeshivas is, after you learn Chafetz Chaim, there's not much Lashon Hara you could say, right? Even the leniencies are not such leniencies. There are times where it's mutar. There are times that you want to tell someone about a certain store. There was an electronic store in Givat Shaul that forged their heksher, their kashrut l'shabbat. Really, their refrigerators did not have the thing that makes it that on Shabbos they don't act, and they just forged the heksher. So there, you might want to tell your neighbor, hey, you know, if you're going to buy electronics, and I hear you're looking over there, you should know that there, your point, again, when your intention is to warn someone of something, if it's for good intention, you want to ensure someone doesn't get burnt, so there, we could say, if it's already been advertised in the newspaper that the store was caught, I could tell other people because my intention is positive. There is another heter called Ma'ase Amcha, if someone doesn't behave like a Jew. I don't know if we should be looking for the kulos in that. There's a bug in a house over Shabbos. How do I get rid of it? I cannot put a cup over it. That's called tzad. You captured it. What you could do is use a broom and sweep it out. You could also put it in a vessel where it's not caught. Right? We had this big, it's not a centipede, with a lot of feet that ran very fast that came into the house. Now, if you put it in a big bucket or in a big box where you still can't catch it, and then you toss it out, that's okay. The idea of a broom is that it's kila achar yad. I'm not directly moving the bug. It has to be that I don't think I'm going to kill it. You know, you bash a spider, you know you're going to kill it with the broom. So long as you're not confident you're going to kill it, you could move it out of the house with a broom. Chemical heating pad. So the halacha discusses a chemical called seed, which was cold, but when it came into contact with hot things, it would become hot, and that's Aser on Shabbos. And that's why we're not sure which chemicals are included in the prohibition that the Gemara spoke about in seed, and that's why we don't use chemical heat, meaning that they had a pachita lohetet, they had this cup that had two chemicals. You turn it, and then it would reach 95 degrees, it would heat up your coffee. So we don't do that on Shabbos. The last point, which I'm not going to go into this time, we'll go into next time, is old parents. When it comes to pikuach nefesh, so people sometimes analyze Shabbos incorrectly. And there are two points I want people to remember. Number one, when a person reaches a certain age, so almost everything is pikuach nefesh. People shouldn't be so quick to say, well, it's only A or it's only B. If under normal circumstances you would think to take this person to the hospital, don't be so quick to say it's okay. In pikuach nefesh, when there's room to doubt, when there's room to think maybe it's pikuach nefesh, it's pikuach nefesh. And the second point that people forget is blood pressure. Sometimes a person's in pain and people say it's only A or it's only B. And it's not only A or B because you have to factor what that does to the person's blood pressure. I've had numerous times this comes up. I speak about it in shul almost every month because almost every month a shaila comes up where people did not respond correctly. Where there were situations that people should have called an ambulance on Shabbos, and this happens almost every month. People, Baruch Hashem, are very careful about Shabbos. We also have to remember that when there's room to think there's pikuach nefesh involved, you don't have to be the world's biggest doctor. You have to have room to think there's a danger, and then you have to act. And a person, the level of where it came to, it shouldn't get there. And again, every month we run into this. I don't think there's a month I don't talk about it in shul. And every time I talk about it, it's because I get burnt again. It's another story, another situation that happened on Shabbos, where people did not go to the hospital and they should have. And when people pass a certain age, people are by their 90s, you have to realize that small things are big things. I would end with one simple point. When parents reach a certain age, for simple things, take them to the emergency room because you want the blood work done. We've had too many instances where people thought it was just a little thing, and even the doctors thought it was a little thing. Had they gone to the emergency room and had the blood work done, then they would have realized that it's something more serious. When people pass a certain threshold of an age, so I tell people, at this age, you don't fast on Yom Kippur without asking your doctor. I don't care that you feel well and your medical case is right. I want to hear from your doctor, you're okay. And past a certain age, when medical issues come up, you get serious care. You don't take it lightly. The same is relevant to Shabbos. If you feel that this might be dangerous, if you feel, hey, the person's in serious pain, so serious pain at a certain age becomes pikuach nefesh. And also, remember to factor the blood pressure. Blood pressure isn't a joke, and people forget it. People think, they look at a medical scene, and they say, it's only A. Remember to ask yourself where the blood pressure is holding. So we covered Baruch Hashem a lot. Yisher Koach, all the questions were interesting, and we'll see if people have more questions because we covered almost everything by now. So we'll see if people have more questions if we'll meet again. Yeah, say that. Say that.